the thing to realize is that under international law, the Catholic Church is what's called a TNCO, a transnational criminal organization. It's laundering money for organized crime. It's associated with criminal bodies. It traffics human beings and children. It's had a history, centuries of active genocide against any non-Catholic people, not just indigenous, but Europeans who weren't Catholics, like my Huguenot ancestors in France. Like anybody who isn't in their little club can be killed legally under their law. So that's not just a transnational criminal body, but a genocidal body that's a threat to anyone on the planet. So they, under international law, TNCO doesn't have the right to its own funds. People can lawfully seize the assets. They can seize the property. They can arrest, perform citizen arrests on their leading officers. So that's something we're all obligated to do, not just allowed, but obligated to do under international law. So that's why we bring this in, right? Activate this.
Exactly. And just to lead on to this, because, you know, my viewers are also a lot of intelligence agency victims. As you were describing the precise, you know, conditions to be classified as a transnational criminal organization, I actually thought every single one of those is also satisfied by the CIA and MI6. So, you know, with the same thought process, and by the Air Force, by the way, the Air Force also has been engaged in genocide and even of the American people in California recently, but is also involved in human trafficking and, you know, laundering money and all this sort of stuff. So actually now, you know, maybe this is the time to get onto what the hell to do about it. And you have a lot of experience how to set up these common law courts. Could you talk us through the process of how do you go from basically from ground zero to setting up one of these courts and really bringing down these bastards?
Yeah, well, it's laid out in the book. There's a 12-step process in there. I should just a little bit of a preamble to that is when people go into courts now, it's designed to intimidate. Judges are like secular, what priests used to be. They're these mystical figures who seem to have all this knowledge and authority, and we're not allowed to confront them. Well, traditionally in the common law, by common law, there's the tradition comes out of the Northern European Saxon tribal people, and it got codified first in England. We know of Magna Carta and that. It developed because people needed a counterweight to absolute monarchs, whether popes or kings. And it developed really in local what were called shire courts. And the word sheriff actually comes from the word shire reeve. A reeve was like a local headman. And for all the shire, and he became the sheriff, he appointed people to guard the community. And part of that was convening 12, usually men, to constitute a jury. And they were the center of authority in the court, not a judge. The king tried to come in and appoint judges all the time. But a judge is in a common law court is simply an advisor to the jury. He gives them points of law. He educates them about whether they have jurisdiction or whether on fine points of law, but he doesn't have the right to nullify their verdict or rewrite the court record or any of the nonsense judges do now, right? That's an admiralty system, and we can talk about what admiralty law is. But so in order to come to that, we have to overcome the psychological fear and dependence on these authority figures. And one way to do that is we begin in workshops by saying, there's an issue in your community. Let's say it's chemtrails or corruption, police violence, children being trafficking. The very first thing you do is you name it. And what you do is you, even if you're one person, you can issue what's called a notice of claim of right. And a claim of right is saying, I, a flesh and blood man or woman, am naming this wrong in the community. Here's the perpetrators. Here's what's going on. Here's the remedy I want. I am calling for 12 men and women to come forward to constitute a jury. And you put that notice out, you have 30 days to respond, and then you form your jury. And prior to that, though, you need to have your case, you know, together. You need to convince the jury with solid, irrefutable evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. And so you have to have done your homework. You have to have somebody like you who's very knowledgeable on an issue. And you the most important figure in the preparation of the case is the citizen prosecutor, because they conduct the case. They call witnesses, they subpoena them. And so the citizen prosecutor and the sheriff are the two figures you need traditionally, a sheriff can actually convene juries and convene courts. The American sheriff system is the only one in the world where the sheriff is elected by the people locally. They're not accountable to the government, but to the local electorate. And they can remove corrupt judges. They can convene juries. They have tremendous power. And that's what a common law sheriff does. So you need a sheriff. You need a citizen prosecutor and then the jury. The spark is the claim of right, but then you convene it and you conduct it according to due process, which is the people who you name are presumed to be innocent. It's the onus is on you to prove their guilt. There has to be a process where you notify them of the action against them. And the first step is what's called an information or they call it a voir dire in England. It means to see and say. It's when both sides come together and look at the evidence. And ideally what you want to do is work it out before going to trial. You just kind of, this is what common law encourages, people to get together and work out their differences. And if they can't be worked out, then you go to trial. Well, with the people that we're taking on, their normal reaction is to just blow us away and ignore us. But that's working against them. Because under the law, when you ignore a charge being publicly made against you, against your good name, let's say Jorge Bergoglio is a child rapist and a child trafficker. If he doesn't respond, that can be interpreted in any court as an admission of guilt because he's not contesting what's being said against him. Silence is consent. And so that can often in court cases, a judge or a jury can then rule automatically favoring the plaintiff who's bringing the case because the defendant is not contesting it. He's not answering the charges. So that can, they're in a double bind. You see, they're in a catch 22 where if they don't respond to us, they can be, the verdict can be found against them immediately without even a trial. If they do respond to us, they're acknowledging the authority and legitimacy of our court and they have to respond and come into it. So you see, we've got a great weapon there we can use all that. We have used that on two cases in the common law courts in Brussels where we convicted Pope Benedict, Queen of England, the other, and the present Pope as well.
This is absolutely fantastic because in my case, I have, I'm just putting it out as an example. So I have taken MI6 to court in 2016. So MI6, MI5, and GCHQ. And the first time I went in for an emergency injunction, it was without notice. So the judge said, let's do it on notice. So the next time it was on notice. And then MI6 turned up. But I've made the case that I really want these directed energy weapon attacks to cease. And what they did is they actually gave me a death threat on the way to my first court hearing. And then I survived my first assassination attempt. So that was their way of answering. But, on top of that, I have served cease and desist requests to German intel, which were not just not heeded. They've, done the most outrageous things inside my parents' home, witnessed by my parents. They've gunned me to bits. I have in person delivered a cease and desist to Swiss intel in 2015. And 2 months later, 3 months later, they actually broke into my home and implanted me in the navel. So I woke up with a surgery scar and they turned on this chip, some 3 weeks later, and I actually measured the emissions from the chip. So their way of answering was always top even more retaliation and even more abuse on them. So now I would be very excited to actually be able to use the proper format, send them a notice of all these crimes and then say, look, I want to take you to court. My question is the following with, are there any limitation periods that people can need to keep in mind, or are we filing under crimes against humanity which do not have a limitation period?
There's no statute of limitation on murder or criminal conspiracy. A criminal conspiracy is two or more people who are trying to ruin your life or target you in some way. And you obviously have evidence for that.
That boxes those ticks.
Not only that, but they have dug themselves into such a deep hole by doing all of that. Because once you document that, you can get an automatic ruling by a judge in your favor on the basis that, well, the defendants were trying to kill the plaintiff, Your Honor. That is a prejudicial act which can automatically rule in your favor if you get the right judge, or in our case, the right jury in the process. Once you file, you have to act quickly because there's a thing called, on the law, vexatious litigation, where people just bring lawsuits to harass somebody, right? It's not a serious thing. So you have to file within 7 days. You file the charge, and then you have to act on it within 7 days. You can't extend it. That's the whole habeas corpus writ was to stop kings from doing that, throwing somebody in jail forever. No, somebody, habeas corpus means produce the body. You have to bring that person into court within a certain day. Usually it's 7 days. It's usually not much longer than that.
That this would be actually excellent because we have so many cases of wrongful incarceration. And I'm wondering, can you use the habeas corpus to also produce, for example, children who have been illegally kidnapped by the state and put into children homes?
Absolutely. And the there's, you know, in America especially, there have been so many successes in doing that, that the courts now are completely totalitarian. They have abolished habeas corpus in many cases. The judges just say habeas corpus doesn't apply here. That should get them removed from the bench. That's a violation of not just common law and precedent, but the U.S. Constitution, which guarantees everyone the right to a common law jury trial in the Sixth and Seventh Amendments of the Constitution. So those judges belong in jail, and yet it's such a criminal system now that you're going to encounter that. So don't forget, everything they're doing to you is an act of weakness on their part. You attack somebody and beat them up and bully them because you have no other option.
Yeah.
If they were operating from strength, they would be in court with you and disproving everything you're saying. But they're acting from weakness. And they have to cover that with a lot of violence and intimidation to make you so afraid that people back off. And a lot of the time it works. But that's the act of people who are whose backs are to the wall. And we have to always remember that. And that's why in many of my books, I print 50 excerpts from Sun Tzu, The Art of War, because he was adept in 3,000 years ago. He knew exactly how a small force can defeat a larger force by thinking, outthinking them and out-strategizing them. And that's really what we have to do.
I think another thing we can also bank on is that this system has gone so utterly criminal, and because they're psychopathic, their way is always to just use, you know, intimidation, rape, and murder to try to silence people. And if they're cornered anyway, they will just pile on rape and murder. And that's what they do. So this is what they do in the individual cases. So all the people who are chipped would be, for example, raped more intensely or tortured more intensely through the chip implants. And this is what's happening to me with my head chips and a lot of other things. And then they would be gunned with directed energy weapons. And the closer you are to success or getting something done or talking to an expert who actually supports you, the more you get gunned. So therefore, they create more and more evidence. You know, and I'm trying to encourage people to think the other way around, to think, okay, this is another great piece of evidence, every entrapment operation and so on. Now, another thing that would be extremely important, is there any way to use these common law judgments to reverse fraudulent judgments by the statutory courts?
Yes, because a common law verdict, even though it's convened by citizens, it's under international law called the Citizens Tribunal. Even though it's not according to the system bona fide, a verdict in any common law court can be enforced by any court in the world. So a court can take our verdict and enforce it, make issue arrest warrants. That's why Ratzinger resigned after he was right in the same month he was found guilty by our court. He knew that he could then be arrested, even if everybody else didn't know, right? You know. So, but yes, it can also be used to overturn other. There's a principle in common law called stare decisis, which means in Latin, the decision stands. And it's the rule of precedent, where common law judges tend to be governed by precedent rather than statutes brought in by government, right? On the other hand, juries can overturn prior decisions. Juries in America have rewritten the law. They've said this judge was wrong. We're bringing a new verdict. And so that's the power of common law juries. They can do that all the time.
And the other question is, do these common law juries have to be in a particular country? Like, do they have to be in the same country as the victims or the perpetrators? Or can, for example, a victim bring, a case in an international arena, say a common law court entirely convened over the internet, where, for example, the jury and the prosecutor and the sheriff and everybody involved might be in different countries, but is connecting on one platform and would be broadcast publicly and live? And can that verdict then also count in, you know, internationally?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, for reasons of security, that's exactly how we have to do it. If you have everybody together in one room, it can all get taken out very quickly. I mean, it's that that reality. But that's how we conducted both common law court cases in 2012 and 2014. That people were linked by Skype. There were 58 citizen jurors in the first case, 32 in the second. A jury can be 12 or more people. A grand jury system in America, they tend to have 25 to 30 people. But yeah, that's the way it should operate, because we're in a global community and you don't have to even bring the case in the country where the abuse happened, where the crime happened. So, you know, it works that way.
Actually, for those people who are using the standard statutory courts, I'm also aware that there's, I think, was it the Rome Treaty, but there was a treaty that decided that actually, in the case of crimes against humanity, you can try that case in, I think, a total of 116 countries. So all the countries that signed up to it, is that right?
The Rome Treaty in 1998, it updated the crimes against humanity, whereby before a regime could hide behind what they called the umbrella of national sovereignty, where they said, well, I'm a sovereign nation, I'm the head of a sovereign nation, you can't try me. And since 1998, that isn't true. There was several attempts. For example, there was an attempt to bring Ariel Sharon of Israel because of his role in the massacres in the Beirut refugee camps in 1982. The day before, the key witness was blown up in a car bomb in Beirut, conveniently, so the trial was never brought. But they, since 1998, the Rome Statute says any signatory to this convention has to cooperate, even if their own citizens or heads of state are accused of crimes against humanity. Now, over 100 countries have signed. America hasn't. China hasn't. Israel hasn't. You know, and so they're not under it. But a lot of other countries have. A lot of the mostly European countries, Canada, England. So under that, you can definitely charge in an international court. Not only charge, but one of the provisions of the ICC convention is, the Rome Statute, is that as a citizen, you're governed by what's called the Nuremberg Legal Standards. There's 10 principles brought in 1950 in the International Court of Justice based on the Nuremberg trials. And it said, if you're a citizen of a country that's practicing war crimes, you are obligated not to pay taxes and not to follow the laws of that regime, because then you're colluding. And in fact, as an individual, you have a responsibility to bring charges against your own country, your own regime that's doing this. And you're not obligated to obey any of their statutes, right? So that's a tremendous weapon in the hands of people. And it's this knowledge that's out there, but people aren't aware of, that it's right in the system. And naturally, we're not going to be educated about it, right?
Absolutely. I think this is the bits that they left out of our school education to be replaced by other stuff, you know? Now, the thing is, with the these are the Nuremberg principles. Now, are these actually binding laws internationally?
They're called the Nuremberg Legal Standards, and they won't find it unless a government brings in enabling legislation. However, that means that these have to be brought, a government has to say, okay, they now apply within our own domestic laws, right? And a lot of countries, of course, didn't do that. Classic example being Canada signed the Genocide Convention in 1952, but they didn't enable it. So therefore, they could say in principle, yeah, we're against genocide, but meanwhile, they're slaughtering children in Indian residential schools. That is now theoretically not the case anymore with the Rome Statute, because it now says that national sovereignty isn't the final word, that there's a higher legal standard. And that's what they said at Nuremberg, because the Nazis didn't do anything illegal under their own laws any more than Canada or America or any country that's committed genocide did anything illegal. It was all legal, but that wasn't the issue. They said there's a higher standard at work in the world than just the domestic laws of a country or a church, right?
Now, the question is, for example, with the U.S. that hasn't signed the Rome, is it called the Rome Statute? The one about, I'm sorry?
The Rome Statute of 1998, yeah.
The Rome Statute of 1998. So China, Russia, the U.S. and Israel haven't signed it. Now, for those targeted individuals in the United States, does that mean that they would have to convene a grand jury entirely inside the United States? Or is the common law actually independent even from the Rome
It is. It's the basis of everything. The common law has universal jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. It has authority in every country because it's the law of nature. It's what we're born with. It's our inherent right to do that. It's not given to us. It's just inherent in being a man or woman, right? And so, you can convene those courts regardless of what the statutory provisions are in any country. That's the power it has, right?
So this means, I mean, this is very, very important for the case of the targeting victims, the victims of the military and the intelligence agencies, because there are so many of them in the United States. So basically, the way I envision this is that one serves the, what was it called? It was the notice of, whatever the hell is wrong, right?
Claim of right.
The notice of the claim of right. So you would serve that. And then you would, convene a jury. Do you invite the jurors to join? Is that how it works?
You put out a call for 12 men and women. And you have, like, in a normal court, you have, like, jury selection where you both sides get together and they can interrogate the jury members and decide to dismiss them or include them. That's part of the early pretrial process, right? In our case, it'll be likely that we'll be bringing the case unilaterally against this defendant that's not responding. And we then have more leeway because they've decided not to come to jury selection. So we can just choose the jurors, right? I mean, we're giving them the opportunity. It's up to them if they want to respond or not.
Yeah, this is so sensitive for the case, in the case of the intelligence agencies, because they routinely plant fakes all the time. So, if you are on the side of the victims, I guess you would have to make absolutely sure that none of your jurors are planted, by the intelligence agency. So my gut feeling would be to go for people with an established track record as activists or, as crime fighters who have actually brought charges.
Yes, definitely. And I should say on that, another point is that jurors have to be knowledgeable. They have to be fully aware of all the facts. And somebody who's already aware of the issue is very much like that. So they can make an informed decision. And that's very important in law, that it not just be somebody says, oh, I don't like him, he's guilty. It's got to be based on hard evidence and your own knowledge. And so that's a very important thing, what you're saying.
Yeah, in the ideal world, I would like to convene a jury where the jury members are all experts in the different aspects of these crimes, because the typical intelligence agency crime would involve, mass surveillance, would involve a black budget, would involve, child abuse or some forms of abuse and torture, nanotechnology or at least microchip implants, telecommunication systems, gang stalking and human intelligence. And these are such expertise areas that you don't really find them, in the everyday common man, just walking down the street. So they are mostly overloaded. Now, the other question is, so as I understand it, even for the victims in the United States, it would be perfectly fine if a jury were convened. It would be held online where maybe everybody's scattered throughout the world. There's no boundaries on the jurors, on the prosecutor, on the sheriff, on the judge who is in an advising position, or anything like that. To me, it sounds like that the common law is really the way to go, right? To unify us all around the world.
Definitely. Now, don't forget, in America, people have an added weapon that they don't have in other countries. They have a constitutional right to a common law jury. Okay. No other country in the world provides that. So in America, people shouldn't just immediately run off and form their own. They should try to do what we've talked about, which is you have a parallel system going on. You work through the existing courts. You say, I want a common law trial. And it's very easy to get that in America, a jury trial. Unless it's on a politically sensitive issue, the government intervenes in that. But I mean, and so you might find that happening. But we can use the system, and you get a lot more mileage and exposure that way. And I would say in America, try that as well as starting your own process parallel to it.
And is there any restriction on, for example, in the direction of, oh, you can't try the same case twice? So would there be any complications if you would have two parallel court cases running?
No, because it's not in the same jurisdiction. And that's the point. You would say, okay, like in America, there's three levels of courts. There's a district court, there's a circuit court of appeal, and then there's a Supreme Court in Washington. And the courts of appeal rule on the lower courts. and the same court can't try a case, but a separate district court can, right? It's all about jurisdiction. And, you know, that's like the Queen of England can't be tried under Crown law, but she can be, and she was tried under common law in our trial in 2012.
And what happens if for whatever reason of sabotage or misfortune or whatever the hell, a trial kind of goes bottom up, a common law trial, and maybe ends up with, say, an unjust verdict? How do you appeal that?
Well, in the system, you go to a court of appeal in America. There's usually courts of appeal, and most countries have the appeal process built into the court system. You try again with a new person, a new issue. You just keep at it, but we always have to think in terms of power and politics in this, because courts, especially in common law courts, they're theaters, they're public. You're putting the system on trial, and so you want maximum participation, maximum transparency, and embarrass the shit out of these people, right?
Yeah.
That's the whole point of these things. It's nothing in common law is closed. Jury records, court records, final verdicts, they're all public record. They're all open to everybody for examination. And the whole process should be conducted that way from the very beginning.
Absolutely. I mean, this appeals to me quite a lot, because I was always of the opinion that what we need to do to circumvent any unjust gag orders, especially from the national security, fraudulent national security corner, is to start putting everything, make everything public from day one, so that people can use backup copies and distribute the information. Even if the individual is gagged, you know, there would be thousands of people around him or her who can still spread the information of what actually is going on.
That applies to verdict and enforcement as well, which is a very important issue. We should really talk about that. How do you enforce the verdicts? Yeah. And the whole community is expected to enforce the verdict, right? That's why I said earlier, anyone can go in and seize the funds in a Catholic church and say, you're going to use this for criminal purposes. I'm going to hand it out to the homeless people outside. That would be a perfectly legal act under international law. So enforcement by the communities, that's a key element of common law.
You know what? I mean, now that I actually know that the Vatican has been, convicted as a transnational criminal organization, and every person has this. I didn't know this, for example, but now that I do, I'm thinking there are literally millions of people visiting the Vatican every year, and you can see these incredibly long queues, you know, queuing up, trying to get into the Vatican, and by the way, paying a lot of money just to get in, right? And just to maybe go up to the tower, and it's for me a huge mafiosi operation. But what if all these people would actually be queuing up with little leaflets saying, well, you know, I'm confiscating all the stuff that I see inside, you know, I'm taking this this golden chandelier here and this golden candle holder, and I'm going to, you know, sell it on eBay and distribute the money to the poor. Can they do that?
Let's sack Rome, people.
Yeah, let's sack Rome, you know.
And, Garibaldi did it. Napoleon did it. They removed popes, there's a precedent for these things, especially now they're convicted and it's out in the open.
Well, you know, I mean, the other thing is also the popes also did is confiscate a lot of artwork. So the Vatican gallery, for example, is absolutely chock full, but so chock full that they can't even accommodate all the stolen loot. So you would have, you know, a broken off toe from a Roman statue and a broken off arm on the windowsill, you know, and just absolutely scattered. But according to what you say, it would actually be perfectly okay to organize, you know, that you turn up on a day and you just go into the Vatican. Now, what happens with the city boundaries? Because they're actually a state on themselves, aren't they?
They're not actually. There's a good English writer. He's a lawyer, Jeffrey Robinson. He's written a book called The Case of the Pope. And he systematically looks into all of the fallacies legally around the Vatican. There's a thing called the Montevideo Conference of 1933, and international law defined four characteristics of a state. The Vatican has two of them. You need a stable population, geographical area, your own. I forget all four of them. But anyway, they don't qualify for a state under international law. And but they're called what Robinson calls a Santa Claus state, where, you know, you tell the kids there's Santa Claus for make-believe, you know, so you don't disappoint them or whatever, right? You lie to your children that there's a guy called Santa Claus. you lie to the world that the Vatican is a state because it performs a very important function for government. It keeps people mentally enslaved. It sucks their money. The Vatican Bank, as you know, is the laundering for these criminal banks all over the world. It's important to keep the aura around the Vatican that it's not only a church, but a government, right? We're in the hats of the world and heaven all at once, right? So that's what the two keys represent on the Pope's flag, the keys to heaven and earth. I mean, it's this big lie. It's the biggest lie in history, right? But so it's another lie that it's a government. Now I forgot your question. What was it originally?
Yeah. My question was that if there's any sort of limitations arising from any state boundaries that one would cross going into the Vatican.
The Italian government has a thing, the Concordat it signed with the Vatican, which recognizes a boundary. If you look at an aerial photograph of St. Peter's Square, there's kind of a parking lot. And then that church where the sacrifice is going, I mentioned it, the San Lorenzo Church. But then you've got the city of Rome. And the Roman police are not allowed to come into Vatican City unless they've been invited. But they could. I mean, they could. That's why Ratzinger is still hiding out there, because they have this agreement with the Italian government that he won't be arrested. But they could go in there tomorrow and arrest the guy. The Vatican has special prisons. They've got papal prisons where they put people.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
I mean, it's ridiculous. Then again, it's also quite handy, you know, depending on what you want to do. Now, I'm thinking if the Italian government and the Italian police, you know, has some kind of agreement and can't go in. I mean, that's fair enough. But then there's one element that we're leaving out, and that's the Swiss, right? There's the Swiss guards who are going in and out. Now, what if the Swiss guards somehow, you know, decided to just cancel the service contract that they had for 800 years, and on their last day of, service, go in and actually ransack the place and come out with this stuff ready to be uploaded on YouTube or on the Sotheby's website to be sold off, right? And then also the other thing to consider, I mean, I'm actually quite serious. People maybe don't realize, but I am serious about this. And the next step up, or maybe, you know, at the same time, is people in Britain have to realize that the same thing applies to the City of London, right, which at this moment has these, different tax laws, as in no tax laws inside the City of London. And that is where the vast majority of the banks are actually headquartered, exactly for tax purposes. So in other words, this entire contract that governs the City of London, that too, and the entire guilds can be, you know, maybe a common law court could find that they are also a transnational criminal organization, and therefore they do not have a right to their own property. Because, and by the way, the same thing could be found about Deutsche Bank. That for sure is involved in everything stated above, right? And also paying for genocide. So in other words, all, you know, the big diagram that I showed in the network of global corporate control, the leading banks. I mean, if the Vatican Bank is the Vatican is a transnational criminal organization, so are all of these. So their assets could be seized as well, right?
Absolutely. The sky's the limit with all this stuff, because it's like an imaginary system. And when you pierce the illusion, their whole legitimacy falls apart. But it's that... that's we have to demonstrate by example. Now, what you talked about doing actions in Vatican, we've proven that in practice you can do that. We've often occupied Catholic churches. The police never intervene because they know we're standing on legal ground. They're publicly subsidized, taxpayer-supported institutions. So we have every right to go in there, whether it's in Rome or anywhere else.
Absolutely. The other thing that also strongly appeals to me is actually this duty of every person to stop paying taxes if it's found that their governments are involved in genocide. Now, I assume that this is even more the case if it's found that their government is involved in their own genocide, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It applies to both. And, you mentioned that a lot of your... the cases are in America. People in America really need to know about this thing called RICO, R-I-C-O, Racketeering Influenced and Corruption Organization Act. It was brought in 1970, and it allows, before that, you could only go after criminals individually. RICO says that there's all these the organizations around the mob, including the Catholic Church, which launders money for them, and, you know, they're good. Now, under RICO in America, any organization that's laundering money for the mafia, that's providing cover for them, that's providing service or support, they can all be tried as well. So under RICO, the head of the Catholic Church, including the Pope and archbishops and cardinals in America, can all be arrested as being accomplices to the mafia. They should be under these RICO laws. So you should really read a precedence of that if you're in America, because it's a great way to confront the system and say, why are you not only supporting the church and not arresting them, but allowing them tax exemptions and concordat agreements where you're funneling American taxpayers' money to the Vatican Bank? That's open collusion, and you can embarrass the system to back off or to do support what you're doing, right? Because they're so complicit.
This is fantastic, because there is the equivalent in the United Kingdom. I think it's, maybe it's not the exact equivalent, but the one that comes to my mind is also just a thing called, it's called something along the lines of Profiting from the Proceeds of Crimes Act or something like that. So in other words, you know, that money that comes from, you know, is actually from organized crime, you have to pay back so people can get hold of your assets. Now that I think should also be applied a lot more than it is. Now, what I'm also thinking is that there are parallel campaigns, for example, regarding the smart meters. Now, with the smart meters, people found out that their electricity company would put in a smart meter that's actually emitting a pulse every few seconds that is irradiating them at very high intensity, and it's going through several walls. So you're being regularly irradiated by this device. It also has, I think, surveillance capabilities. It's like a little, you know, radar thing that is being pulsed off. Now, there, they use templates. So they had certain templates that people could fill out and make a case and then just file it with the utility company. And they discovered that as these utility companies kept getting these filings, they suddenly started backing off and, allowed people to, get rid of the smart meters or revert back and stuff like that.
That's a very important point, Catherine, because the system is far more vulnerable than we realize. That's why they have to create this aura of infallibility and power and violence around themselves, because they know that we find time and again with churches, corporations, governments, anyone, military, if you shine a light on them and keep at it, and they know you're not going to back off and there's more than one of you doing it, they get very scared and they start falling out, and you start seeing insiders coming forward and talking about what's going on. And that's why public pressure constantly and exposure is so important for all of this work. That's really our weapon. Our weapon is the truth and our numbers and our persistence, right?
Absolutely. Now, the what I also wanted to ask is, if we thought, for example, okay, how about in our, going forward, there would be certain templates that people could use. So let's say templates to start filing, cease and desist or whatever. There's a certain selection of things that people need to do. Which templates do you think would be really helpful? If people wanted to move towards common law courts? And are there any such templates already out there that people can use?
Well, the ones you've been doing are very admirable. I mean, it's very organized. It's a system, a way. You see, the most important thing first is information, that verifiable research and evidence. You can't do anything without it. You need your evidence solid. And so any template that you can do, which actually documents, not just anecdotal testimony, but backed up by documentation, by usually more than two witnesses to confirm something, witnesses able and willing to come into court to confirm their testimony. All of that is needed first. That's kind of the basis of everything. And cease and desist orders are really interesting, because they can be used as a way to, like I say, create this theater where you're taking this and you're filming, knocking on the door of this official and saying, you will cease and desist. Because if they don't, they're actually in violation of, there's this thing called a true bill. I don't know if you know the meaning of that. True bill in common law is, I take out an ad in the paper. Let's say somebody has stolen from me or is harassing me and trying to kill me. In your case, somebody's targeting you. You take an ad in the newspaper and say, I charge this person with this. They are doing this to me. If they don't, you publish that three times. If they don't respond, it becomes a statement of fact under the law. It's a true bill. It means it's not contested by anybody. Therefore, it's fact under the law. And you bring that into court and say, Your Honor, I accused this person three times of targeting me with directed energy weapons. They never responded. The judge then has to rule, or the jury, bang, it's a fact under the law. They are doing this to Catherine Horton. I mean, that's an amazing power people have, right? And again, that's another template you can use, right?
Yeah, and I think that there the hurdle is actually getting adverts published by the newspapers, because I tried. I actually tried publicizing my case in several things, and the advert was actually cancelled. So okay. Sorry.
When that happens, it doesn't have to be in a newspaper. It's any public statement. Like when you're calling a jury, you can hang up a flyer on a tree or on a lamppost, and that's a public notice. The true bill can occur if you put it up on a website, on a blog site. If you make public notice, yeah, it's got to be a public notice in lieu of a true bill. It's leading up to that, saying, I am putting this person on a notice. I am charging you, like, you know, Emile Zola, j'accuse, right? I accuse you of these crimes. What do you have to say about it? No response. And then your third one can be, I am notifying the world that they did not respond. This is now a true bill, a fact under the law.
Happened. Now, yeah. The question is, would it be possible to pull that off so that I, for example, put something on my website, which could be a PDF or just the written statement, and this is the, you know, the first statement, and I send the link to all these agencies and I say, I accuse you of this and this. This is a public statement on my website. I draw attention to it on my YouTube channel. Maybe 1,000 people see it. It's out there. You know, I send the YouTube video link to these people and then I do this 3 times. I mean, I can already tell that none of them will ever respond. And then by the third, that's it. Or does it have to be a different platform?
No, it can be. It doesn't have to be the same platform, but it can be. You've published it 3 times. You've got the evidence that's being published 3 times, and the evidence that they've never responded. You see, we have them in a corner, and people don't even realize that because they're not allowed to respond,
yeah.
Right? And therefore, we've got them over the barrel. It's just a matter at that point of making it public enough that when the prosecution happened, people know that we've achieved something.
Yeah.
Right. Like when Ratzinger resigned, everyone knew right away, and boom, people knew, hey, we can bring down popes, right?
Yeah.
And at that point, you can issue common law arrest warrants to say, okay, I'm getting asked the jury to issue an arrest warrant against this person. And then you need sheriffs to help enforce it. It's great. You can ask the local police, you can deputize them as common law sheriffs to help enforce this arrest warrant.
Yeah.
Then charge them with obstructing justice if they don't. I mean, it's great. The important thing is it's an ongoing process. You got to keep at it all the time, right?
Yeah. And also, I think what I really like about it, because in the case of the targeting cases, so many people are involved, and they are either involved by active collusion, active participation, or they are really helping a lot by just, the dereliction of duty by just denying help and refusing to help. And every single police force I have heard about falls into that category. I am not aware of a single police investigation having happened ever in the last 20 years in the case of targeting. So now I think I really like this method, because it sounds like you can kind of get them involved, like, you know, in a snowballing process, and in the end get police forces and maybe police chiefs to be charged, yes, as well in turn, right?
It's a classic example of the jiu-jitsu you can do on the system. You can use their weight against them because you know they're not going to respond. Well, then let's exploit that to the hilt.
Exactly.
They're not going to respond, so let's utilize that against them.
Oh my goodness. Okay, guys, I'm really excited because I've just realized, I mean, in a sense, if I put out public YouTube videos and I keep sending cease and desists to, let's say, MI6, MI5, GCHQ, German Intel, and the Swiss Intel, and let's say I've done it 10 times and they haven't responded once to my accusations of the fact that I'm being, you know, hit with directed energy weapons and tortured with chips and raped with chip implants, I can already tell they haven't replied, not just 3 times, but I think 10 times. And I think out of these 10, I think MI5 was the only one to ever reply once. And all they did was send me an email to thank me for my comments. That was their response.
Right. That's not a response, though. That's not a substantive response. So.
Exactly. So I guess with this, I can now go into a court and actually present this as fact, as undisputed fact.
Yeah, but no, I can help you with that. You got to present it in the form of a plan for a true bill.
Yeah.
And you just state to the court, this is a fact now. They've not contested it. We want a ruling from your court that it's fact under the law.
Yeah.
That they're doing this to me.
Wow. Now, Kevin, do you think we can put together, bit by bit, all the different documents and turn them into templates so that people can download it and do the process with me so that we can have this amplified, hopefully 1,000 times or more?
Yeah, I think that, yes, very much. And that what we just talked about in terms of doing the 3 times, charging people 3 times, and then applying for a true bill statement of fact, that's the way people can go because we're all being targeted in one way or the other, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'm really excited because my personal goal is, as I said to the viewers, those who know, I wanted to start already filing, starting in March with start filing the affidavits and start filing for emergency injunctions in the standard courts. Now that got delayed because I was physically mauled to bits, absolutely to bits. So what I really want to do is get the cases ready to file emergency injunctions, but at the same time also start all these common law courts. And I think if you sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish.
No, because I think as soon as the hardest bit for every victim is to write up their evidence and to bang their case into shape, into a court bundle, into a binder, ring binder, that's a court bundle, with all the particulars of claim in the UK court, your witness statement, your evidence, your expert testimonies, and all these other stuff. That is a lot of work. But once you have done that, you can file it in a standard court or you can file it in a common law court. And then we can really start acting against these criminals.
And 2 points on that. The first one was cooperating in this because in between April 14th and 21st, there's an international week of action by the ITCCS about Vatican crimes, making the citizen arrests, seizing the property and assets. Like we're going to be during Easter week, that's going to be really turned up to the maximum. Now, during that same period, we can draw the links between the Vatican Bank and these other attacks, right? The Vatican is heavily invested in energy weapon development. They're all in the arms industry, all of this. They're laundering money for the same people that are doing these crimes. So we can tie the campaigns together, and I think we should be thinking in terms of that mid-April period as a way to kind of kickstart the whole thing. I mean, I think there'd be a good we could really help each other that way.
Absolutely. The other thing is anything that is, taken, confiscated from the Vatican, I think should be used to pay the victims, the child abuse victims, because this institution hasn't really paid any significant damages, has it?
Never. And in fact, with a few cases when they do, their insurance companies cover it. So the Vatican Bank doesn't lose a penny. Now, there's a thing called right of reparations under international law. When you've been harmed, either as a people or individually, you have a right of reparations. And if they don't willingly give it, you have the right to, in some cases, you sue them in court or make direct reclamations, they call it, international law. You can go in and seize the assets of these people. So that's what we do. Like they've done that. Native people in Canada have done that. They go in and seize the local Catholic church on their reservation. They boot out the priest. They take over the building.
This is brilliant.
And they have the right of reparation under the international law because for hundreds of years, we've all been ripped off, right? We've had fraud perpetrated on us. We have the right to reclaim that wealth stolen from us. And
Absolutely.
the criminals are doing it. So that's an important issue. Right of reparations, very powerful, right?
Oh gosh, guys, keep notes because basically, I mean, to me, it sounds like we all should just, I go onto the website of the Vatican gallery and pick whichever painting we like the most,
Well, your local church too.
Your local church, that's right. This Sunday, go around your local church and think, how would that look like on my mantelpiece? Or how much could I get off that on
We
Sotheby's?
did that once in Canada. We got all like, because a lot of the native people doing the protests are quite poor. So one Sunday, we told all the homeless in Vancouver, come on down to Holy Rosary Cathedral. There's going to be free food. And there was, but also we went in. We walked to the front. We had some burly Indian guys with us who were able to do this. The priests were, they didn't know what to do. We took the collection plates, we took it outside, and we started handing it out to all the homeless outside. And there was like a riot. The priests didn't know what to do. The people were laughing, had a great time. And I said to them, I was on a bullhorn, I said, according to Jesus, this is what the church should be doing anyway. Take all that you have and give it to the poor. Well, we're just enacting the gospels here. Why aren't they, right? And, it's great theater when you do something like that, when you have a lot of people around you. And so we've got to be really creative. something and be daring. Something you said earlier, really important. You talked about people gathering their evidence and it's hard for them to take it down. Just a practical suggestion. Whenever you write down evidence, do it in point form, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and stick to facts, not assumptions, not speculation. Because, you know, when any of us are being targeted and are harmed, we get very consumed in the details of the wrong done to us. And somebody who's listening to that, it's hard to sort out the facts from the fog and the emotion. You've got to be really emotionless when it comes to documenting what's happened to you. Say, what are verifiable facts that I can prove? One, here's what happened this on this date. Name dates, times, places. Always name names. Don't talk about people in the abstract or groups in the abstract. It's got to be individuals. You know, the old saying, evil has an address. You've got to name the address, the date, the incident, who did it, when, how, why, all that. And that also helps us. It's a bit of therapy because by having to do that, we get outside our own pain for a minute. And we're saying, well, how would a court view this? How would somebody else view this? How maybe I should view this now, right? Rather than just poor me, it's now how are we going to get the bastards, right? And so it shifts, it turns the tables a bit by doing it that way, right?
Absolutely. And having worked with a lot of victims and, you know, going through ongoing cases around the world, I can tell you that there's a lot of emotional upheaval. And, you know, when I read sometimes witness testimonies or how people communicate with courts, you're absolutely right. And I'm guilty of it exactly as well. It is extremely emotional. And then it just it becomes very, you know, overbearing and the judges can't get to the facts. Whereas if you really use every fact as a weapon, and you think every paragraph is a punch, how can I punch and who do I want to punch in the face and with what exactly? This is brilliant.
You got it.
Yeah. So one of the things is, so I'm aware of the time, would you be willing to actually work with the targeted community and help us draw up these drafties things and actually do it with us?
That's what I do. Anytime.
Thank you. Because I really want to take this seriously. And what I want to do is I want to empower the victims. And as I said, they are numbering in the absolute thousands. Most of them are very scared and they don't really want to come forward, but they do come forward when they see that there's genuine progress. So what I envisage is that there will be, you know, first of all, kind of test cases, you know, in the sense of real court cases, but with the most, the best documented cases, the people who are not scared to come forward, you know, who are fully informed. And what I also have in mind, and this applies to all these cases against these huge organizations, is I also want to have a form of witness and victim protection scheme put in there, which means that all the witnesses are, so we do the exact opposite, because with the intelligence agencies, keeping things secret is impossible. They have your entire community and your history mapped before you even got targeted. So what I really want to do is make the full list of all the witnesses and all the vulnerable people public, or at least known to the jury or some trusted network. So should anything happen to these people, should their cat, you know, start to fall ill because pets are killed off, you know, loved ones are killed off as retaliation. And then, of course, the witnesses are killed, you know, in the worst cases, so that we really de-incentivize this kind of retaliation. Because if I remember, you also had some mysterious deaths with these court cases that you were involved with, right?
There have been 6 deaths of Aboriginal people in our network, and we've proved that definitely in the case of 4 of them, there was foul play. The most infamous one was William Coombs, who saw Queen Elizabeth abduct those children from a Catholic Indian school. The week before he was to come to London and give testimony, he was taken to St. Paul's Catholic Hospital, died the next day. According to the attending nurse, he had all the symptoms of arsenic poisoning, not tuberculosis, as they claimed, right? You don't die in a day from TB, but you do from toxic poisoning. So that's the example of what they do. But that's because they're Aboriginal, they're poor, they're isolated. They can be knocked off easily. We need protection around us. We need public exposure. The more bold you are, the more protected you are.
Yeah. One of the things I really want to have is also a support network, or like an emergency call network. And the other thing that I think can be put in place is that when you're in this phase of you know, really testifying, you need to let people know, I mean, ideally daily, that you're still alive by just, you know, pinging the outside world. And when it gets really to the actual court case, maybe even hourly, you know, to make sure that you are fine, so that the network can start acting. And I think we should also identify the people who would be the most likely culprits. Because in the case of people dying of arsenic poisoning, when it's about the church and the state, I can immediately say that, you know, Canadian Intel, MI6, and also the Jesuit network would be the prime suspect. And then actually they among themselves know who did it. So you only need to grab hold of the collar of one of them and squeeze him administratively until he tells you who did it, because it's all arranged. Absolutely.
That's right. And, you know, in the case of directed energy weapons, don't forget that the prototypes were tested out first on children.
Yeah.
Indian children, especially in Canada. Canada was a testing ground for a lot after World War II. More Nazis were brought to Canada than any country in the world. More of this experimental stuff began in Canada than anywhere. Places like the Allen Memorial Institute in Montreal, where they did the first testing on mind control techniques and that kind of neurotechnology you talked about. At least in North America, that's where it was. And so when you look into these Indian hospitals and the research we've done at murderbydecree.com, you'll find out where a lot of this stuff began and how it began, right? So that history, and it links the issues that way as well. And the Vatican keeps popping up all the time in all of this stuff, right?
And if I had to bet, the same hospitals are involved to this day, or at least researchers who have been trained at these hospitals and maybe went to other hospitals would be continuing. Because typically the way researchers work is that they build up their expertise and then, you know, early on, and then spend their entire career working roughly in the same type of area. So it's very easy to take these people out. Kevin, I'm so grateful for the time that you have given into, you know, educating us, and also for writing this book. So I'm saying to everybody now, please get this book. Please, you know, read it. Please read the 12 steps. And, you know, if you have any comments or criticism, get it in now, because this is the format that I would like to use to move forward. I'm also trying to work with the standard courts, but I my personal experience is that they haven't really helped. So I'm already prepared.
The whistleblower manual is kind of a companion to the common law training manual. It gives you a lot of good tactical and strategical points about how to take on big adversaries.
That's, oh, this is excellent. This is the Sun Tzu manual for the 21st century, right? So just hold it up again. It's called A Manual for Whistleblowers and Hellraisers. And I'm pretty sure you can actually get it from the, you know, from the standard booksellers, because I have seen that book.
It's Amazon.com. You can get all my books at Amazon.
Fantastic. So I if I remember correctly, that book was also about, you know, the psychological resilience and how to cope with fighting them.
It's very personally written. I went from my own experience and other people who I had worked with, kind of got together and said, like, what did we really go through? How was it for us? How do we survive, right? And how kind of the hidden story in all our suffering was, it was meant for a higher purpose.
Yeah.
And we learn, we have great strength once we get past our individual pain and look at the higher purpose of what we're doing, right?
Yeah, I can confirm that once you get past the personal pain, it is actually extremely empowering. And you realize suddenly that if you just keep at it, you know, like Woody Allen said, you know, half the battle is just turning up, you know, just if you just keep at it, eventually you will just make, you know, huge progress without really knowing how the hell did I get here. So I think people get the second book as well, because, you know, I can confirm that the psychological side is, you know, pretty much half the battle.
And so, one of the quotes I like in here is, power is not what you have, but what your enemy thinks you have. And right?
Absolutely.
It's all about perception. Anyway.
It absolutely is. And, you know, I think more and more will come to the point that we will have so many people supporting us that we will be surprised how much actual power we have. We will be surprised, and our enemies for sure as well, you know? So, Kevin, thank you very much. Do you have any final words, parting words to the audience?
Well, just keep in mind that mid-April period, and my radio show is every Sunday, 11 p.m. Greenwich time, on bbsradio.com/herewestand. We'll be giving regular updates, and murderbydecree.com. You can write to me, thecommonland@gmail.com.
Thank you. Actually, I will also include all the links below the video to Murder by Decree, to your radio show, and also put in your email, because I think now as we're moving forward, you are one of the key leaders and movers and shakers in this. So, you know, please, please follow Kevin on his radio show, you know, bookmark it and make sure you keep up to date, because things are moving fast and the world is changing, and for the better this time. So thank you very much to you all. Thank you for listening, and bye for now. Hope to keep you updated. Thank you.